Hello and welcome to Yes Indeed Pod, a podcast about indie tabletop role-playing games where I interview creators about their games and inspirations and about the theory, process and practice of game design. My name is Mark Shepherd, your host today and always, and your friendly local indie enthusiast. This week, we're talking to Dominique Dickey and CJ Linton about Tomorrow on Revelation 3, a sci-fi game about community and survival on a hyper-capitalist and hyper-segregated space station that may or may not be an oblique commentary about the world we really live in. Now that's out of my head and into yours, let's talk indie. So today we're talking to Dominique Dickey and CJ Linton. Hi there and welcome to the podcast.
Hello, hello. Thank you for having us.
Absolutely no problem. Would you like to take a minute to introduce yourselves and let me know what you do in the indie tabletop role-playing game space?
I do a lot of GMing and mostly for friends locally and a little bit online, and have written two solo games before Dom and I worked on Tomorrow on Revelation 3. And I guess I would say a lot of my work is really interested in how people handle really challenging circumstances and what it looks like to gamify that in a way that is narratively engaging and cathartic.
Nice.
And I'm a writer, editor, and consultant working in RPGs and adjacent media, I would say. I'd written one solo game as well as some like contract work before we came together to work on Tomorrow Revelation 3. And what primarily interests me in my solo game design and in coming to this project was looking at how can we ask questions about social justice and about equality and use games as a vehicle to force people to look at hard truths about how the world is currently set up, with the hope that you come away from that game experience thinking about concrete action you can take in your real life to make the world better. And that sort of drove me through Trial, which was the solo game that I put out last fall, and this game as well.
Wow. Lofty goals, both of you. And I really appreciate that kind of style of game design where you kind of look at catharsis through play, but also like the idea of being able to develop, well, as you put it, concrete action through gameplay, you know, kind of to formulate a worldview and as a designer to get across the ideas that you're trying to get across in terms of what people can do as kind of street level activism and things, you know. I think that's really interesting and very cool. I'm very, very down with all of those themes that you were talking about there. The game that you mentioned there, both of you, was Tomorrow on Revelation 3. Do you want to take us a little bit through, well, a bit of an elevator pitch as to what that game is?
Yeah, sure. I can give the like elevator pitch, which is that it's a tabletop role-playing game about surviving and building community on a hyper-capitalist space station in the far future. So Revelation 3 is a space station in another galaxy. Well, no, it's another star system that is sort of based on it, like the life on the space station is structured around a set of very rigid social stratifications.
Right.
So what deck you live on the station dictates your profession and your income and what resources you have access to. And a lot of these things are hereditary. And that's where the game sort of picks up. And then players play as characters from a variety of decks, variety of background circumstances, who are coming together to try and improve life on the station, which is sort of a nebulous goal and can take very different directions depending on what the players are most interested in about the sort of base conditions of the world.
I mean, there's a few themes there that I think, you know, we're doing that kind of classic sci-fi thing of reflecting modern society in something that's kind of futuristic and fantastical in order to kind of analyze it from various different lenses. So, you know, you're talking about hyper-capitalism, which is not that far removed from maybe what the world looks like at the moment. And you're talking about extremely stratified societies, which again is kind of aligned to a lot of people's experiences of all parts of the world. So is that your sort of design intent there, to reflect the worldview that maybe you would like other players to experience?
I think that we were pretty explicit about, and I think this is kind of an oblique approach to the question that you just asked, maybe, but I think that we were pretty explicit about when we were writing the game and thinking about the world building and sort of setting up the most sinister ways that capitalism is functioning on the station. We were very aware that all of the things that we were dictating as truths of this world either are happening somewhere on Earth or have happened somewhere on Earth, or at this rate will happen soon somewhere on Earth.
Yeah.
I honestly think that what that approach reminds me of is Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, where I think when asked about like her approach to world building and her approach to gender stratification, she said that like all of the elements that seem the most egregious either were happening somewhere on Earth or have happened somewhere in recent history. And that approach sort of fueled a lot of our world building.
Like, we are very explicit that like this space station is hyper capitalist, which I think is important for the game. I think sometimes in science fiction media, kind of the exploration of totalitarianism and capitalism gets a little blurred. And so we wanted to be very intentional in the game that a lot of the social control people, like the illusion of choice, you're technically allowed, but the economic circumstances that you are experiencing are preventing you from doing any of the things that the station maybe says that you technically would be allowed to do, which was very interesting to design.
I mean, the kind of thing that it reminds me of before the word became an aesthetic is cyberpunk and that kind of genre where you are explicitly exploring what it looks like to be human in a way that interacts with extremely diabolically minded corporations, you know, who are interested only in profit, like by any means. Does that kind of design philosophy feed back into your play? You know, are you a cyberpunk game, or are you a sci-fi game investigating the similar themes that cyberpunk does?
It's very funny that you say that, because the tabletop game that we both played first and most substantively was Cyberpunk 2020.
Yep.
And some of the games we've written and explored since are actually the feeling that like cyberpunk often does exactly what you said, and sort of gets lost in the aesthetics and doesn't succeed in, I guess, what you could ostensibly call the cyberpunk project. So we were definitely thinking about that with this game.
It is wild to me that that game was made with 2020 as an endpoint for humanity.
Yeah.
The re-release of Cyberpunk Red last year made me chuckle somewhat, you know. But yes, I mean, to kind of go back into it a little bit, I mean, I think it's really interesting to investigate what it means to brush up against arch capitalism in this sense. I mean, what is it that the characters are actually like intending to do on this space station? An exploration of what capitalism does to you, or is this kind of anti-capitalist in the sense that he wants you to destroy capitalism?
Okay, I was going to say that it's sort of the second, and that it's an exploration of how capitalism affects you, but it's also an exploration of how people can push back against capitalism collectively.
Right, yeah.
What the characters do, what we say, like, in longer campaign play, you play until the station is somewhere that you would genuinely want to live.
Okay.
What the characters aim to do is to just try to improve life on the station for themselves personally, but also for the greatest number of people possible.
Yeah.
It's a pretty open sandbox. We certainly have outlined some problems on the station that characters can try to like aim to fix, but I'm absolutely certain that in the process of solving food inequity on the lower deck, something's going to come up about like another great egregious issue, and then your next step is to solve that thing. So they kind of spiral out, like the problems will just keep coming, because the way we've sort of set up the text for the GM facing and player facing, just to think about what is like the most sinister thing that capitalism could be doing in a given situation, and then sort of think about the most community oriented way that you could push back against that.
I see where you're coming from with that though. So your GM is explicitly a sort of the monopoly man, you know, just like pushing and trying to break the back of the people who are working against them. And then from the other side, you're saying, well, what if we just all stood up to you at once? I like that idea of, you know, explicitly driving cooperation from players and characters. That's pretty interesting, yeah.
It's a little bit like that. I would say in terms of the gameplay, the GM is actually like not that antagonistic.
Right.
Because we sort of wanted to set up the structure of the game such that meta-narratively you're already working collaboratively sort of in a more similar way that your characters in the game would eventually hope to. The GM does, in phases of gameplay, have the role of presenting the antagonism of the station, but that the relationship between the GM and the players is, the GM is sort of just a player with a different role.
Okay, yeah.
So the players are actually at times playing the NPCs, and sometimes those NPCs are going to be people that are part of the mechanisms of the station that are conspiring against their characters.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And Dom, you were also talking about how, well, one of your intentions was to kind of make people think about ways that they can do kind of resistance in their own lives as well. I mean, what sort of form does that take, and how can you kind of protect people against bleed in that environment as well?
There are a lot of negative associations of bleed where you sort of experience your character's negative emotions and then you bring those out into your life.
Yeah.
But I also think that there are ways to sort of facilitate entanglement of your identity with your character's identity, or facilitate pulling out your character's positive emotions or your character's triumphs or your character's good traits into your everyday life, and then using those things to fuel you. An example is like, and I guess this would apply in any system and not just in Revelation 3, but if you were like a more shy, introverted person and you took it upon yourself to play a super witty character, and then through the process of like collaborating with everyone else at the table and the process of like getting more and more into that character's mindset, you found yourself becoming like quicker with puns or quicker with one-liners, and you started off as this super shy person and through this play experience become more like agile in conversation.
Yeah.
I think of it as facilitating experiences similar to that of like the environment of the station is pretty negative, and the GM isn't antagonistic, but the GM does represent the ways that the station is sort of beating the characters down. But the characters also, there is a great capacity for them to experience triumphs. There is a great capacity for them to make positive change and to feel proud of that and galvanized by that. And I want to encourage players to bring those feelings with them out into their real lives, and then to seek those feelings out sort of on the top side in their real lives. So if you do work in the game that fixes an educational inequity, and that makes your character feel a certain way, a certain positivity and a certain feeling of having accomplished something, then you bring that feeling with you out into the real world, but then you're also, I guess, looking for what are real world ways that you can get that feeling. And that might be by going to a city council meeting or something along those lines. It might be campaigning for something that's important in your neighborhood. And those are ways to, like, the bleed gets you started, but then how do you perpetuate that feeling once you've gotten a little bit of it?
Yeah. I think that's really interesting because, like, you talk about how bleed is associated with negative emotions, but also, like, actually sometimes negative emotions are quite useful in terms of inciting you into action. Like, rage can be a potentially extremely useful emotion because it can push you into doing something that perhaps if you lacked confidence, you may want to shy away from, you may hesitate from doing. So, you know, it's interesting how we kind of typically associate bleed with negative emotions. So
I would also say that for us, and it's in the game text as well, a lot of being able to explore challenging topics in a healthy way in tabletop games is being very explicit and intentional in the context of your play about what you are comfortable with and what you want to explore. And it is definitely not at all unique to this game, but there are some people who are going to find it very, maybe not enjoyable, but cathartic to replicate the things that they experience negatively in real life in a game like Revelation 3 and try to solve those problems. And there are some players that are going to say, actually, I play tabletop games not to replicate the systemic forces that ruin my life and deal with those. I'm here more out of escapism, or I'm seeking different things.
Yeah.
So I think there is a way to play this game in both ways, for sure.
And I mean, it's definitely about having that honest conversation between players, within players, we're including GMs there, and saying the way that you interact with this game outside of the game is entirely up to you, and that's not on me at all. So I think it sounds really fascinating, and like, it's an interesting way to frame a game and to very explicitly frame social issues into the game itself. So, you know, kudos for that. It sounds awesome.
Thank you.
What's the kind of mechanics of the game? Where does it sit in a kind of role-playing game genealogy?
I guess to start with mechanics, it is very simple. Your character has 4 stats, then you roll a d10, their numeric stats, and then 3 traits, 2 which come from your background, which is like a would maybe be called a class in other games. And then 1 that you select. The traits are all things that sort of modify your ability to be more successful in certain situations, or introduce world building information, or maybe change the outcome of a die roll. I would consider it pretty mechanics light, just in terms of the number of stats. We really wanted people to not feel boxed into trying to solve a problem in a specific way.
Yeah.
So the stats that we have, and we changed the name of one of them, so I might get it wrong. I believe it's social, physical, mental, and technological.
Yep, you got it.
Amazing. So those are between 1 and 6. So I guess sort of an example of that is something that comes up in like every tabletop game, is that there's invariably some sort of charisma stat or seduction stat. And there is obviously not one in Tomorrow on Revelation 3. So if you're trying to persuade someone to do something, like maybe you're talking to a station administrator and you want a favor, you're evaluating the mechanism through which you're trying to persuade them to do that. Like, is it you're just really attractive and you're vibing right there? That's maybe a physical role. Are you impressing them with your knowledge? That's maybe a mental role.
Yeah, yeah.
That's obviously a very reductive example that I would hope doesn't apply, or maybe not hope doesn't apply. Like, by all means, play out your seducing station administrator fantasies in Tomorrow Revelation 3. But
sure,
the hope is that kind of people can really be creative with how their characters are attempting to approach whatever kind of problem that they're addressing.
Yeah, and I suppose that kind of leans back into the theme as well, which is that a lot of this is kind of punk theme, which means it's kind of a small group against a big group. And what you're describing here is, or what you've explicitly said, is that it's about finding the most appropriate solution to a problem and not necessarily the most effective. That's pretty cool. So, you know, it's always nice when you can tie those themes back to the mechanics as well as like the aesthetic of the game.
I was gonna pop in on cultural capital, which is that I can describe what it is, which it's a fixed stat. No, it's not. It's not fixed. You can modify it in the downtime phase, which we'll get to. It's a stat that is a numerical value for each deck, where your cultural capital represents how familiar you are with the people and the customs of that deck. If you're like a deck A administrator, then you would have very high cultural capital on deck A and very low cultural capital on deck E, which is like one of the lowest decks of the station.
Right.
You can add it to rolls either before or after the fact if the roll takes place on the relevant deck. It's sort of like being able to say, like, oh, but I know a guy, or oh, but like, they like me because I've interacted with people on this deck previously, or like, oh, but I know a sort of like obscure social tradition of this deck that I'm able to bring into play in this conversation to make this interaction go the way that I want it to go.
Something that we were thinking a lot about with this game is that different people have different skills in different contexts. And it's not just like you're a good engineer, so you can always do engineering. There are a lot of situations where even maybe a really socially savvy character will go somewhere and not have the social knowledge to be able to be successful there. So the cultural capital stat is functionally intended to reflect basically that being from the place you're from and the experiences that you've had there are important and will help you connect with the people there and the problems that people there are facing. Another thing we were thinking a lot about is we didn't want the game to turn into playing out kind of a savior situation where the people on deck A with a ton of money and resources can just swoop down to deck E and automatically have the proficiency and skills to fix everything.
Yeah.
And with the way the stat distribution works, even a very like strategically statted administrator from deck A, if they're on deck E, is not always going to have the skills to solve all the problems.
Yeah.
So that was sort of, those were sort of our two goals.
I mean, I really like that as a design because that kind of has a very obvious real world analog as well. You know, just because you know a lot about one particular city, for instance, it's kind of meaningless when you move to another city, right? That kind of extends as well across social circles and technology, as you say. So it's really interesting to kind of look at the way that you are developing that. And you were talking about how that can change during downtime phases. So I guess you have uptime phases as well.
We have the downtime phase and the mission phase, where during the downtime phase, I think what mechanically distinguishes it is that you can take actions without risk of failure. So in the downtime phase, there's complete success and success with complications, but it sort of defangs the more adversarial elements of the station. And during the downtime phase, you can gather equipment, you can build cultural capital by sort of creating relationships or maintaining relationships on different decks.
Yeah.
You can ameliorate conditions. So if you were injured or took on a social condition, then doing work to solve that. And you can also just do like slice of life gameplay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And play scenes that sort of ground the player characters within their communities.
Yeah.
And establish why they're doing this often dangerous work of pushing for social change. Who are the people that inspire them and who are the people that motivate the changes that they're trying to make? And to further serve that end, during the downtime phase, if I'm a player and my character does not appear in a given scene, then I can play an NPC in that scene.
Yeah.
Which works to make each player, because the players are generally from different decks and different backgrounds on the station.
Yeah.
So sort of sharing the burden of playing all these NPCs makes it easier for the GM to juggle every character's community, but it also makes each character's community ties, whether that's family or friends or whatever, feel real to all the other players at the table.
That makes sense.
And then there's the mission phase, which is when the players have a clear objective of what something they want to change about the station and how are they going to change it.
Yeah.
And they go about doing scenes trying to make that change. And the mission phase ends when they either meet their objective or there's also, you're allowed and encouraged to change your objective as new information comes up during the mission phase. Maybe you realize the thing that you're trying to do isn't feasible, or maybe it's just not the most helpful course of action. Well, in that case, you can sort of have a team huddle and come up with a different objective. And the mission phase ends once you've met your objective. And during the mission phase, you only play your PC and the station is more adversarial. So there is more room for failure and the stakes are higher.
Yeah.
The one thing I would add with the downtime phase is, like, a line we have a lot is that it's a game about surviving and overcoming capitalism, but to do the overcoming part, like, you're also living your whole life at the same time.
Right.
So spending time with the people who are a part of that and seeing how you are persisting in the small ways in between all of your work of activism and action against the station.
Cool. Again, I mean, that's very realistic. in a good way, you know, it's good to play kind of realistic characters in a kind of futuristic, wacky, well, not wacky, but a futuristic setting, which is only a slight extrapolation of perhaps the world we live in now. So what I would say is that all sounds very cool. I understand this was on Kickstarter in March, but what's the kind of timeline now for having that out in the world?
We finalized the main text of the game. We have most of the art in. We've got maps that are super sick that show all the different decks of the station.
Oh, cool.
We have most of the starter adventures, one of which was written by me and two of which are written by stretch goal writers. And then we're waiting for one more. And we're going to layout super soon. And we're on BackerKit taking more pre-orders if anyone else wants to get on this before it's too late.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
We said we were shipping the game in September, which is probably still going to happen, which is super exciting. And then there were a couple like little rewards that were just Kickstarter specific that we're starting to work on.
Awesome.
Now that the main text of the game is done.
Well, fantastic.
If you backed on Kickstarter, add a tier that gets a custom postcard. We're going to start working on those.
Oh, that's cool. That's a nice touch.
Yeah.
Thanks for taking us through all of that. It sounds really good. If it sounds up your street and you can cope with the ravages of capitalism, then please go out and check out Tomorrow on Revelation 3, which sounds like it'll be out in September. So amazing. Thank you very much. Would you like to take a minute to let us know where we can find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter at Dom S. Dickey, as well as at DominiqueDickey.com. I am pretty vocal on Twitter about like what I'm up to in the RPG space, as well as what I'm up to with regards to process updates for this game. We share lots of like little sneak peeks and screenshots of the content.
Awesome.
Yeah, there are some Easter eggs in there if you want to go look for them.
Great. Yes, that sounds up my street.
I am on Twitter and it at Near Futures. And I have a website at cjlinton.com. I think that is all of my links.
Well, I forgot to plug my itch. I'm Dom S. Dickey on itch also.
Thank you very much. And I guess all that remains for me to say is thank you very much for coming on Yes Indeed Pod.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. And thanks again to Dominique and CJ for the interview. As always, you can find all of the links in the episode description. Next time, we're talking to Jeff Stormer, podcaster extraordinaire and designer of Anyone Can Wear the Mask. This is the last episode before I'm taking a month-long break in August. There's also a chance it won't be released on time, so sorry in advance if that's the case. This week, I'd like to thank our Patreon backer, Georgie Batts, a longtime friend of the show and two-time former guest. Georgie is one of my favourite people in the scene, and I'd love it if you could check out air games like Far From the Tree and Exquisite Polycule. And you, yes you, can get a shout out like that too if you go to patreon.com/yesindeedpod and sign up today. You'll get access to our Discord server where we can hang out and chat and even join monthly editing streams and the Yes Indeed Pod book club. Most of the money will go directly to creators rather than to me, so you'll be investing directly in the indie scene, which will make it a healthy and inclusive place for years to come. And if you can't commit regularly, you can always help out by rating and reviewing the show wherever you find your podcasts, or by donating through the Ko-Fi page at ko-fi.com/yesindeedpod. Of course, you can always reach out to me through Twitter at yesindeedpod, that's YESINDIEDPOD. I'd love dearly to hear from you. Lastly, music credits. The intro music is by my amazingly talented friend Gemma Hooper, and the outro music and interstitials are from BitQuest by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com and filmmusic.io. Thank you, Gemma and Kevin. Until next time, remember, does indie need you? Yes, indeed.